Okay, well, good afternoon. Thanks for calling in today. Today is Thursday, June 7th, and we're presenting part one of our Ethics Refresher 2018, which is just kind of a summary of the Minnesota Rules of Professional Conduct. And over the course of the next 3 hours, we are going to plod through those rules pretty much in their entirety. And it's quite a bit of material to get through, so we'll just keep blasting through it. Now, I always warn people at the beginning of this program that in some ways you will really not get your money's worth out of the program, because all we are going to be doing today is looking at the actual text of the rules, you know, what Rule 1.1 specifically has to say. And as you will discover pretty early on, very rarely can you sort out the ethical dilemmas that we encounter from time to time simply by looking at the rules. Usually you have to dig in a lot deeper, and just knowing what the text of the rule is probably isn't a great deal of help in those complex situations. So like I say, I always start out with that caveat that, well, unfortunately, you're not going to get your money's worth out of the program. Now, before I have people start clamoring for refunds, though, I will point out that you will get your money's worth in a couple of ways. First of all, you will get CLE credit for the program. And believe it or not, most attorneys who take my Ethics CLE programs are taking it because they need the CLE credit, because Minnesota, like most states, requires a certain number of hours of ethics. Minnesota, it's 3 hours. Most states have a similar requirement, and that will indeed be satisfied today. Each segment of the program is being offered for 1 hour of CLE credit, either as part of the live program today or as part of an on-demand podcast that some of you might be listening to. So you will get your credit, but the other reason why I discovered this is actually kind of a helpful program, even above and beyond the ethics credit that you're going to receive for taking it, is that, well, when I put the program together, and I've been giving this program now for several years, but the first time I put the program together, I did realize something, and that was, I had never actually sat down and read the rules from cover to cover for a very long time. And in fact, the last time I had actually sat down and read the rules from beginning to end was back in law school, shortly before I took the multi-state professional responsibility exam. So I did discover that it is a good idea occasionally to go through that exercise of seeing exactly what the rules have to say, because fortunately, I hadn't violated them any over the years because of this, but I did realize that some of the memories from back then were maybe just a little bit fleeting, and perhaps I had forgotten that there was a very specific rule covering some subject. In many cases, the problems that come up in the practice of law, Neil, there is a very definite answer in the rules of what you're supposed to do. So it is a good idea to be reminded of that from time to time. Over the years, it actually doesn't happen very often, but the rules do get amended from time to time. So it's a good idea to make sure we're up to date on the most recent version of the rules. So that's what we'll be covering today. So like I say, we'll just be plodding through what the actual text of the rule has to say. I will try to make that process as painless as possible and hopefully somewhat interesting, but hopefully we'll have a little bit more familiarity with the rules when we're finished, and we'll get those all-important CLE credits out of the way. And speaking of CLE credits, for those of you who are taking this program as part of a podcast that you're listening to on the Internet, in order for me to record the attendance and keep track of the time that you've spent listening to me, I will be giving a series of code numbers during the course of the program. So when I give a code number, write that down and email it to me or get it to me after the program so that I know you were paying attention. And I'm not heartless, though. So if you're listening to this while you're driving your car, I don't want you to start fumbling for a pen and pencil to write it down while you're in traffic. So if you do miss a number, just explain the circumstances, and you don't have to go through and listen to the program a second time, as long as you were listening the first time. So like I say, those of you taking the podcast, and there will be instructions on the website on exactly how to get those to me, but write down those code numbers that I give during the course of the program. Well, like I say, the scope of this program is going to be simply covering the actual text of the rules, and more often than not, though, when you get difficult ethics problems, you won't get a lot of guidance from the actual black and white text of the rules. So the advice that I give in those situations, that after reading many ethics opinions from the Minnesota Supreme Court and other state Supreme Courts, the main advice I take away from those is that if you ever do find yourself in a situation where you don't know exactly what you're supposed to do as an attorney, talk to another attorney. Either, not necessarily a formal consultation where you, have to get a formal legal opinion from them, but more often than not, just informally consulting with another attorney. So running it past the attorney down the hall, talking to some colleague, or even calling me when something comes up. Oftentimes can really help you resolve the situation. Not because that other attorney is any smarter or more ethical than you are, but a lot of times simply when you're in the midst of some big dilemma and you don't know what to do, sometimes simply the process of forming that question might be the thing that suggests the answer to you. A fresh set of eyes looking at the problem can often resolve things. And like I say, I've discovered that in practically every ethics opinion that I've read. There are some where, the attorney is just plain old dishonest, probably wouldn't help too much in that case. But most often, when an attorney gets into some ethical problem, what's happened is that they make a small mistake, they keep compounding the error in some way or another. Whereas if they had just stopped as soon as they realized that there's a small mistake and run it past the attorney down the hall, that other attorney will say, well, you can easily fix that just by doing this. The many cases where somebody just keeps getting dug in deeper and deeper because they have this problem that they just don't feel that they can talk to anybody else about. So that simple task of talking to another attorney can often solve the problem. And like I say, when I read those ethics opinions from state Supreme Courts, more often than not, it seems that if this attorney who got him or herself into a lot of trouble had simply taken the time to run it past somebody else, that would have solved the problem. The extreme version of getting outside advice that I should point out is that in Minnesota, for example, and I think a lot of other states, I as an attorney, if I have some problem that I can't figure out what I'm supposed to do because the two rules that I'm looking at seem to be contradictory. In Minnesota, I can at any time during normal business hours just pick up the phone and call the Minnesota Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility, tell them that I'm an attorney, and tell them that I need an advisory opinion about what to do in that situation. As long as I disclose all of the relevant facts, I'm pretty well protected if I take their advice. So that's always a recourse that's available that we should keep in mind in Minnesota and other states where it's available. Now, the reason there are a couple of reasons though why I've never done that. Number one is because I'm scared of those people too. I don't like making that phone call. But the other thing, you do have to make the full disclosure. And if you make that phone call, well, then you're kind of stuck taking their advice once they give it to you. So if you call up and say, well, what should I do in this situation? And they say, well, just give all the money back to the client. That might be a possible solution, but maybe there was some other solution that you could have done that would have also been appropriate. So, but keep that strategy in mind. Now, one thing, if you're a member of a state bar association or maybe a county bar association, most of them have some kind of ethics hotline. Some of them are better than others. I'm not a member of the Minnesota State Bar Association, so I don't know what they have to offer here in Minnesota, so that that recourse is not available to me. For the Wisconsin attorneys who are taking this program, I've heard nothing but glowing reviews from the ethics hotline of the Wisconsin Bar Association. Every attorney, in fact, most of the Wisconsin attorneys I've talked to have at some point called that number to get advice, and always reported getting good advice. And since they're required to be a member of the Bar Association anyway, it's a very good service to have available. So for the Wisconsin attorneys taking the program, or other states where that service might be available, keep that in mind. Other states are not quite as good. I had one attorney who was admitted in both Wisconsin and another state, which I won't name, and he routinely calls the Wisconsin number, even though his main practice is in another state, just because the quality of the Wisconsin program is so much better than the other one. He's tried calling the other state, and they don't return his calls or whatever. So, but for the Wisconsin attorneys, that's a very good resource available. The last resource I just want to point out, it's in the written materials, is an ebook entitled Minnesota Legal Ethics by William Wernz. And that's a treatise on legal ethics in Minnesota. But since Minnesota follows the same rules as almost any other state, it's also relevant to attorneys in other states. So I recommend that book for a couple of reasons. One is that it's free. It's made available by the Minnesota State Bar Association, so you can it's a free download, and you can so if you need some reading material to put on your Kindle or whatever, you can download that and have that available. And the other reason, though, that that's a pretty good book is because it's actually interesting, despite the topic material. Because it's written by William Wernz, who served as the director of the Minnesota Office of Lawyer Professional Responsibility for many years. And as a result, it's just the book is full of all kinds of interesting war stories about his days in that office, about all of the shenanigans he encountered by Minnesota attorneys over the years. So it's actually kind of an interesting book to read. And like I say, it has the other great redeeming quality of being free. So you might want to check that out, like I say, either if you're in Minnesota or some other state. At this point, I'm just going to pause for that first code number for our podcast listeners. So the first code number, they will all start with the number E, or letter E for ethics, E-161. E-161. E-161 is the first of our code numbers for today's program, E-161. Well, with that introduction, I'm just going to jump into what the text of the rules has to say. And we start with Rule 1.0, which is simply a list of definitions. And I'm not going to waste anybody's time by reading through definitions, mostly because there's nothing too profound in the definition section. Words that are in there, words that are used in the rules, for the most part, have their standard dictionary definition, and the definition section doesn't add a lot of light to matters. What's a client? Well, I think I know what a client is. You know what a client is, but maybe in those gray areas, the definition of client might clear things up just a little bit. The only two definitions in there that I can think of that might depart a little bit from the dictionary definition are the definition of signature and writing. Writing, you think of that as being ink on paper in some form or another. Or probably you think of it as being, an electronic document. And those would both be right. An electronic document is still a writing. But the definition is even a little bit broader than that. It says that anything that's preserved in a permanent form is actually a writing for purposes of the rules. So therefore, a voice recording. The podcast that some of you are listening today is actually a writing because it's a a permanent recording of some audio. So that might save you in some situation where you discover to your horror that something was supposed to be in writing and you don't have the writing. I sent an email to the person, or even I left a voicemail for the person, because that voicemail is a recording, or is a permanent recording of something, so that might qualify as a writing. And similarly, the word signature can constitute just about anything that the person thinks of as being their signature. So either scribbling with ink on a line, or an electronic signature, or could be something even broader than that. Somebody is simply saying, yes, I agree to that, could constitute a signature. So again, just keep in mind that there is a rule 1.0, a list of definitions. So if you ever do encounter any ambiguities when you're trying to figure out what some rule means, well, try looking up the words. Maybe that'll help a little bit, or maybe it'll make matters worse. But at least you'll know that that's there. Well, the first substantive rule is one where I will definitely not be able to provide much value from today's program, because for rule 1.1, I am going to do little more than read the rule to you. Rule 1.1 says that when you're representing somebody, you shall provide competent representation to your clients. You have to be competent. That's the first rule. Well, what does competent mean? Well, unfortunately, I can't help you. I can't answer that question for you, other than as Justice Stewart would probably say, I'll know it when I see it. So I don't know if we can really define what competence means, but it's just good to remember that's not only what people are paying us for, but that's one of our ethical obligations too, because Rule 1.1 says we have to provide competent representation. And the only definition they give us is that, it requires the legal knowledge, skill, thoroughness, and preparation that are reasonably necessary for the representation. You can be competent the first time you do something. So if you're a brain surgeon, for example, there comes the day when you have to show up in the operating room and you have to do your first brain surgery. So the mere fact that this is the first time you're doing it doesn't mean that necessarily that you are not competent. So you don't need many years of expertise in order to make yourself competent. As with the brain surgeon doing their first brain surgery, or the attorney handling their first trial, or the attorney drafting their first contract, you might need to acquire that competence through reasonable preparation for that particular case. So competence does not necessarily mean many years of experience in some particular area, but it does mean that you have to acquire that competence prior to actually representing somebody. So anyway, Rule 1.1, like I say, you didn't get much value out of the program for that one because you already knew you were supposed to be competent, but that is the first rule. Even though that was the first rule, I would say that the next rule is the most important rule. So what's the most important rule? That's Rule 1.2. And it's another very simple rule, but we'll spend a little bit more time talking about it because I say this is the most important rule because this kind of defines what our job description is as lawyers. And that's actually very simple. I'm going to make it even simpler, but I'm going to add a period, even though there's not a period there, because Rule 1.2 says, a lawyer shall abide by a client's decisions, period. There's not actually a period there because it says comma and then it talks about some other stuff. But the reason I like to put a period there is because just to stress the fact that we as lawyers have to always abide by our client's decisions, always, every time. Unless we can point to a particular exception that says, we don't follow our client's instructions in this case. But the general rule is you always have to do exactly what your client tells you to do, unless you can point to an exception. So in other words, anytime you do depart from what your client has to say, the burden of proof is going to be on you to say that, well, the reason I didn't do what my client told me to was, I didn't feel like it. Well, I didn't feel like it is not one of the exceptions. As long as that person is your client, you have to do exactly what they tell you to do. Now, one thing you are always allowed to do, or almost always allowed to do, that we'll see later on, is you can always quit. So you say, well, no, Mr. Client, I don't want to stand on my head, so I quit. But, you know, if they tell you to stand on your head and you refuse to do so and you can't point to an exception, well, then you violated the rule. And really what you should have done in that situation is say, well, no, I can't do that. Therefore, I guess I quit. And, well, maybe they'll hire you back after you say that, but maybe not. But in general, you shall abide by your client's decisions. Now, unless you can point to an exception. Now, let me tell you about two exceptions that are not exceptions. This rule does not say you shall abide by your client's decisions with respect to important matters. No, it doesn't say that. You shall abide by your client's decision always, unless you can point to a specific exception, whether it's a big deal or whether it's a little deal. And all similarly, the rule does not say you shall abide by your client's decisions as long as it's in your client's best interest to do so. That's not what the rule says. Now, there might be other exceptions that apply in that case. So when your client says, I want to do something really foolish, I want to do something that's going to be harmful to me, well, unless you can point to one of those specific exceptions, you still have to do it. You can't simply say, well, no, I'm not going to do what you want me to do because that's contrary to your best interest. I don't think you should plead guilty because, there's absolutely no evidence against you. Well, but ultimately, though, that's their decision. You shall always abide by your client's decisions unless you can point to a particular exception. We'll talk about some exceptions in a minute, and there will be other exceptions throughout the program. But that's what our job is, Rule 1.2. What do, so when somebody asks you, what do you do for a living? Well, I'm a lawyer. Oh, what do lawyers do? Well, we just do what our clients tell us to do. That's really what our job description is. You shall abide by your client's decisions. Well, the corollary of that is what is after the comma, because the rule says that, because we're simply following our client's decisions, well, that means we're not endorsing what they have to say. We're simply doing our job. So don't hold me responsible for the things I'm doing because I'm just doing this on behalf of my client. Or in other words, our representation of a client does not constitute an endorsement of the client's political, economic, social, or moral views or activities. So, for example, people always, I don't know about you, but people always ask me when they say I'm an attorney, and then they want to ask a real intellectual sounding question. So they ask the question of, well, would you represent a guilty person? And they expect a lot of hemming and hawing and soul searching on my part. And even though I don't really represent criminal defendants, I blurt out the answer. Well, of course I would represent the guilty person because they need the lawyer more than the innocent person does. Well, the reason why I can so flippantly say that is because of this rule. I am not endorsing my client's criminality simply because I'm representing them. I'm simply doing my job. And it was their decision whether to plead guilty or plead not guilty and go to trial and have me represent them. And I'm simply abiding by their decision. I'm not endorsing their criminal behavior. I'm just doing my job of putting the state to its proof. So again, that's why I can so flippantly say that is because I am not endorsing their views or activities. I'm simply doing my job of abiding by their decisions. Now, as I mentioned, there are many exceptions to the rule of do everything that your client tells you to do and abide by their decisions. And one of them is stated right here. And hopefully, this is not one that comes up too often in the practice of law. If you worry about this problem too much, if you encounter this problem, maybe you should go look for some better clients. But it does come up occasionally, so it's good to know what to do when it happens. And that is what we are not allowed to do, even if our clients tell us to, is assist the client in conduct that you know is criminal or fraudulent. So your client comes into the office and, you know, says, well, what would you like me to do? He says, well, I want you to draft this document. You know, I want you to draft this forgery deed that I'm going to use to defraud these people. Well, obviously we can't do that because you know that that's criminal or fraudulent. Or your client, you know, says, well, I need to run into the bank to rob the bank. Can you wait out here in the getaway car? Well, obviously not, because you know that that's criminal or fraudulent. And that's pretty easy to figure out. You didn't need to pay me to tell you that you're not supposed to help your client commit crimes. So that's pretty cut and dry. But there's an exception to that exception. You know, it's an exception that you don't follow their instructions. You don't abide by their decisions. But there's an exception to that exception. Because what you are allowed to do, and really what you're required to do, because, you know, it's your client's decision, what you are allowed to do is discuss the legal consequences of your client's proposed course of conduct to help them make a determination of the scope, meaning, or application of the law. So how could that come up? What would be one of the stickier situations? Well, you're representing the criminal defendant, who is, scheduled to go to trial next Monday, and things aren't looking too good. And your client asks you, does the United States have an extradition treaty with Venezuela? And they just, they just want you to provide that information. Can you answer that question? Now, probably I'm guessing the U.S. probably does have an extradition treaty, but it's probably... we're not on the greatest of terms with them right now. So you conclude that, you look up the extradition treaty. Well, yes, there's an extradition treaty, but for some reason the Venezuelan embassy is kind of dragging their feet on these. So in other words, if you get on a plane to Caracas, you're probably good to go. There's no way the United States is going to get you back in the foreseeable future. Well, are you allowed to tell them that information? Are you allowed to tell them, if you go to Venezuela, I guess you'll be able to avoid trial. Because you're helping them break the law, because there's another law that says you're not supposed to flee the jurisdiction in order to avoid prosecution, and you know that's exactly what they're supposed to do. But I think that comes pretty clearly within this exception to the exception. Because you are simply giving them information. You tell them, don't do this because it's illegal, and you tell them the downside to it. You tell them, well, it's probably not a good idea because unless you come down there with a lot of money, there's really not much food to buy down there. But but simply providing that information, though, I think pretty clearly comes within this, because what you are doing, you're just giving information. You're telling them the legal consequences. The legal consequences are you can't be extradited for the client to make that determination of the scope, meaning, or application of the law. So in my opinion, it would be permissible to answer that question. Now, the prosecutor might have a different opinion. So if that situation ever does arise, I think maybe that is one of the times when I would pick up the phone and call the Minnesota Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility, something tells me that the prosecuting attorney might have a different opinion on that. But I think that's what that exception to the exception means. The other subject covered by Rule 1.2, so anyway, Rule 1.2 is the most important rule because it says what our job is. Our job is to do what our clients tell us to do, subject only to a few exceptions. The other thing covered by Rule 1.2 is says that, yes, you can limit the scope of the representation, but it has to be reasonable and your client has to give informed consent. So in other words, just because you take on this client does not mean you're taking on all of their legal proceedings for the rest of their life. You can limit it to a certain thing. So, you're representing the defendant in the DWI case. You can limit the scope of the representation to say, well, I'm only representing you on this criminal charge against you for DWI. and I'm not representing you because the people you hit are suing you. I'm not representing you in that civil case. That's okay as long as it's reasonable. That sounds reasonable, and the client has to give informed consent to that. In general, that consent has to be in writing. So when that comes up, look at the rule. Because of that limitation having to be in writing, and we'll talk a little bit later if we have time, talking about retainer agreements a little bit. But the one thing to keep in mind is that we are almost always limiting our representation because this client isn't hiring you for life necessarily. They're just hiring you for one thing. So in a sense, you're kind of almost always limiting the scope of the representation. And because this rule says that it has to be in writing, that's kind of a strong case for saying that any time a client retains you, there should be some kind of written confirmation, something in writing, showing what the scope of the representation is going to be. Could you hold just one second, please?
No, not right now, sorry.
Okay, I'm back. Sorry about the slight delay. The scope of representation can be limited. It has to be reasonable. It has to be in writing. One issue that is not addressed in the Minnesota rule but is addressed in some other states' version of the rule is what if you want to limit your representation to simply drafting documents for your pro se client to use? I think that's reasonable. I do it occasionally. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But one thing to keep in mind is that differing states take different views about whether or not you can you have to disclose the fact that that's what you're doing. And there are kind of two schools of thought on that. And I don't know exactly how Minnesota has come down or if it's ever actually been adjudicated. But there are kind of two schools of thought on that of whether you have to disclose your involvement. Some states take the point of view that, if you draft these pro se documents of your client to file with the court, then you're kind of misleading the court, because they think it's this pro se litigant and it's actually an attorney who wrote this stuff. So some states for that reason say that you have to disclose it. Other states on the other hand say, well, no, you don't have to disclose that because, that's none of their business. And also the court's going to figure it out anyway. They realize that some attorney is drafting these things. So some states are not quite as harsh on that. Like I say, I'm not sure exactly where Minnesota stands. Nebraska is one of the states, though, that has written right into this rule that you do need to disclose it. And down at the bottom, you have to put, this document was drafted by, and you have to put your name and address. So when I have situations like that, I have taken to kind of following that safe harbor in Nebraska. In fact, I had one a while back where I was I actually wound up entering an appearance in the case, but initially I was helping the client prepare some pro se documents, and I made sure to disclose, even though I don't think it's absolutely required in Minnesota. I put one of the documents at the bottom, this document was drafted by, and put my name and address, just to prevent any possibility of an accusation later on that I was somehow trying to conceal my involvement in the case. But like I say, there's not a specific rule on that in Minnesota. Minnesota is simply any kind of limitation on the scope of the representation has to be reasonable, and the client has to give their informed consent. So that's Rule 1.2. Rule 1.3 always makes attorneys, toward the end of this month, attorneys will start getting a little bit more nervous when I read this rule, because Rule 1.3 says you're not supposed to procrastinate. And the CLE deadline is coming up here in a few weeks. And I always have I always know what I'm doing every year on June 30th, August 31st, and December 31st. So those are the deadlines for various states when I'm very busy, when all these procrastinating lawyers come out and need to finish up their CLE. And they get nervous when I get the rule 1.3 that says you're not supposed to procrastinate. Well, I tell them not to worry because they have not violated rule 1.3, because rule 1.3 says that you have to use reasonable diligence and promptness in representing a client. And I always put them at ease by pointing out that the reason why they put their CLE off until the last minute is because they've been so busy representing their clients. It's okay to procrastinate in your CLE as long as you finish up by the deadline, but you can't do that when it comes to the clients. You have to act with reasonable diligence and promptness. Not only because there's this rule, but as the comment to that rule states there's nothing more resented by our clients than procrastination. So even if you don't really do anything wrong, the fact that you're procrastinating about something, they don't like it, and they'll find something else to complain about. So don't procrastinate. What do lawyers most commonly procrastinate about? Well, it probably is rule 1.4. The next rule is that the thing that they procrastinate about, and that is communication. So don't procrastinate about anything, but definitely not about communication, because rule 1.4 says that you have to communicate with your clients. Now, fortunately, though, our duty here under rule 1.4 is not particularly burdensome, because the general rule of communication is simply, we have to reasonably comply with requests for information, and you have to keep your clients informed about the status of their matter. So it does not say that you have to communicate every little thing in excruciating detail and tell the client exactly what you did from minute to minute. You don't have to do that. You simply have to keep them informed about the status of the matter. On the other hand, this is one of the few rules where it's easy to err on the side of caution. So you don't have to go into excruciating detail, but you'll never get in trouble by over-communicating. If you over-communicate, that's okay, and you don't have anything to worry about. But on the other hand, if you under-communicate, well, you will get in trouble. So that's one area where I would say always err on the side of caution. Now, I've only had one attorney kind of disagree with that statement. And she kind of had a point, because she was a family law attorney, and kind of an emotionally charged kind of thing, and she discovered that she was mailing copies of every little thing to her clients, and she discovered that her clients were getting these envelopes from her, but they never opened them anyway, because people get nervous when they get letters from lawyers. And that's true even if it's from their own lawyer. So she felt she was just causing undue stress to her clients, and she started erring a little bit more, or not erring on that side of caution, just out of respect to not stressing out her clients too much. So I kind of see the point of that, but on the other hand, you'll never really get in trouble for over-communicating, that unopened envelope, hopefully that doesn't cause too much stress. So I would still err on the side of caution, but maybe apply a little bit of reasonableness in it as well. There are only a couple of specific things you have to communicate listed here, although, of course, there are others. The other general duty is you have to tell your client how their objectives are going to be carried out. The specific times under this rule that you have to communicate are if your client needs to consent to something. So, you say, there was a conflict of interest, but, my client consented to it. Well, the next question is, when did they communicate that consent? Well, they didn't really communicate it. Well, then it wasn't consent. And so if there's any consent, obviously that needs to be communicated. And you also have to let the client know of any relevant limitations on your conduct. So it could be a jurisdictional kind of thing. Well, we could file in Minnesota or in Wisconsin, but I'm not admitted in Wisconsin, so if you hire me as your attorney, we'll have to file it in Minnesota. If that was relevant, you would have to communicate that. If you're going to be on vacation next month, you have to communicate that. So anytime there's any kind of a limitation on your conduct that's relevant to the case, you have to communicate that. The test of whether you communicated enough is, did the client get sufficient information to intelligently participate in decisions? Because remember, Rule 1.2 says they have to make call to decisions. So the test here of did you communicate enough is, did you communicate enough information so that they can intelligently make those decisions? And at this point, for our podcast listeners, at about 38 minutes after the hour, I'll give our next code number, and that is E157. E157. E157 is our second code number for this this part one of the ethics program as we wrap up Rule 1.4. Moving on to Rule 1.5 talks about fees. So yes, we can have our clients pay us money. We can collect fees from our clients, and it's pretty wide open what we can charge because the rule states only that our fees and expenses must not be unreasonable. And I think we even are given kind of the benefit of the doubt there, because it doesn't say our fees have to be reasonable. It just says that our fees can't be unreasonable. So I think that means that the burden of proof would be on somebody else to prove that it was unreasonable. But in any event, you can't charge an exorbitant, unreasonable fee. But once again, the word reasonable isn't really defined. Other than, as like I say, Justice Stewart would say, we'll know it when we see it. But the other rule is the number of factors, the amount of time required. Obviously, the two-hour case, you can charge more than the one-hour case. The novelty and difficulty, whether that case will prevent you from taking on other employment. The customary charge in your locality, not to say that you have to match prices with every other lawyer. But, you know, if you're, if the lawyer down the street is charging $1,000 and the lawyer across the street is charging $1,500 and you're charging $10,000, well, that might be unreasonable because it's so much higher than what is customary in the locality. The amount involved and the results obtained, it's reasonable to charge more in a big case than in a small case. Time limitations, you know, they come in the day before the statute of limitations is about to run out. Well, maybe that makes a difference. The nature and length of your relationship with your client. So your long-time sophisticated clients, you can probably charge more than your brand-new unsophisticated client. Your experience and reputation, you can charge more because you have experience and have a good representation, and whether or not it's a fixed or contingent fee. But those are non-exclusive factors, so there might be other factors. Just, you know, what makes the fee reasonable is just the test of whether or not you can charge it. Now, I don't think I violated too many rules, but the next rule is perhaps the one that I might have violated at some point, because the next rule says that the fee and scope of representation shall be communicated in writing. So how have I possibly violated that? Well, the possible violation that I might have committed of that is because I'm such a nice guy. So that somebody calls me on the phone and says, can you draft this document for me? And I say, well, yes, I'm such a nice guy, I'll do that for you for $100. You know, I bet most lawyers would probably charge $500, but I'm such a nice guy, I'll do it for $100. And I have all the information I need. I'll get to work on it. And I'm such a nice guy, I'll just send you a bill when I'm finished. You don't even have to pay me up front or anything. And the client says, great, and I just get to work. Well, I've probably violated that rule by doing that, because I communicated that fee and scope of representation information, but I didn't do it in writing. Fortunately, I've never been disbarred for doing that, because I think I would have two defenses. The first defense is that if you look carefully at that rule, it actually has the word preferably in there. It says fee and scope of communication shall be communicated preferably in writing. So I'll say, well, you know, the rule is not absolute. The rule just says it's preferable that it be in writing. Of course, I say that, and somebody says, "Well, why didn't you do it the preferable way?" And, well, I don't know. So it's probably best to do it the preferable way and communicate it in writing. Because remember, up above, we said that any time you limit your representation, that does have to be confirmed in writing. So I limited myself to drafting that one document for them. So I think to be on the safe side, when I do have a phone call like that, it should be followed up with some kind of a writing. Now, it does not have to be a writing signed by the other party or anything. It just has to be confirmed in writing. So in that case, if I just shoot off an email to the person, saying, "Thank you for calling. I'll get right to work on this. Here's how much my fee is going to be," that would satisfy that. Now, of course, there might be some confidentiality issues with emails. That's a separate issue. But that is a writing. So I think it is the best practice to follow things like that up in writing. Now, here's one case where the state law differs a little bit, because most states have adopted these more or less identical rules from the ABA model code. Wisconsin, on the other hand, added in the provision that if I think the reasonably foreseeable cost is going to be under $1,000, then they specifically say that that does not have to be in writing. So that's like an added little break for our colleagues in Wisconsin, that they won't get in trouble for that phone call that I just told you about. But that's not the law in Minnesota. It's not the law in Iowa. Not the law in most other states. Most other states say it shall be done preferably in writing. And also in Wisconsin, if you're over $1,001, well, then you probably can't rely too much on that word preferably, because it's such a bright line rule. So that's one thing where I have learned to be a little bit more careful, to make sure I follow up those kinds of conversations in writing. Another kind of fee that's talked about here is the contingent fee. And the thing to keep in mind about contingent fees is that that means any time your fee in the case varies depending upon the outcome of the case. Normally, when I say contingent fee, you think, it means the plaintiff's lawyer gets one-third. But that is one kind of contingent fee, but the contingent fee means anytime you get more money based upon a good outcome in the case. But contingent fees are perfectly okay. They have to be in writing, not just confirmed in writing, but this has to be a formal written contract signed by the client. Kind of outside the scope of today's program, there are some very specific things that have to go in that contract. So before you draft that document, you'll want to look at the actual text of Rule 1.5 to make sure that you have all of the required information in the contract. But as long as you have a written contract, that's okay in any kind of case, with two exceptions. One is family law cases. You can't get a contingent fee in a family law case. So, in a child custody matter, there are three kids. So, the lawyer gets one-third of the kids. No, that's not permitted, because that's a contingency. But it certainly can't get, one-third of the alimony. But remember, contingency means that anytime you get more money if you have a good outcome. So I will not charge you a fee unless we get the restraining order. Well, that would be a contingency in a family law case, and that's not allowed. Or in a criminal case. Contingent fees are not allowed in criminal cases. How can you have a contingent fee in a criminal case? Well, the leading case on that comes from Wisconsin, where I believe it was a Madison DWI attorney was advertising that he would win your case or you get a free bicycle. So it was a very good advertising scheme, I think, because one way or another, your transportation needs were going to be taken care of if you went with this lawyer. Because either he would just win the case hands down, kind of like it never happened, and you would get your car back, your driver's license back, and everything would be back to normal. Or, at the very least, you'd have this new bicycle to get where you have to go. So he thought that was a good idea. But the Wisconsin Supreme Court said no. Because that amounts to a contingent fee in a criminal case. because if you win the case, you get a certain fee, but if you lose the case, you get that fee minus the price of the bicycle. So you get less money if you lose. So that's a contingent fee in a criminal case, and they said you can't do that. And the last topic covered by Rule 1.5 is fee splitting. Now, before I talk about Rule 1.5, fee splitting, I should point out that elsewhere in the rules, Rule 7.2, I think, that rule says that you are not allowed to get referral fees. And if you only remember one thing today, I want that to be the thing that you remember, is that lawyers can never, ever, ever accept a referral fee. You can't pay somebody something to refer cases to you. You can't accept money for referring cases to some other attorney, because that's called a referral fee, and it is simply not allowed. It's not permitted in Minnesota, or in Wisconsin, or in Iowa, or in most other states. Interestingly, in some states, they're perfectly okay with that. For example, Michigan, I guess California, is permitted, but not in most states. Referral fees are simply not allowed, ever. They're not allowed. Never take a referral fee. Now, when I say that, a lot of times attorneys will say, well, wait a minute. I thought referral fees were okay as long as you, and then they will state some conditions, which are about what I'm about to say here in a minute. And, well, they're not exactly wrong when they say that. But what they're talking about is something different, because referral fees are not permitted. What is permitted under Rule 1.5 is splitting the fee with another attorney. So if you and I are working jointly on a case, and you are doing half of the work, and I am doing half the work, it's certainly reasonable that you should get half the money, and I should get half of the money. We are going to split the fee between us. Or maybe, you did a little bit more work than I did, but you still are getting half the fee. So you did two-thirds of the work, I did one-third of work, we're still splitting the money 50-50, that's probably still okay. Or maybe I didn't do a lot of work in the case, but I'm still going to get one-third of the money, even though you did most of the work. That's probably still okay. Well, fee splitting is okay if it is in proportion to the services provided by each attorney, or in relation to the amount of services. So kind of the test is, well, you know, I got this, after the case was over, I got this check for $1,000. Did I provide $1,000 worth of value to my client? And if you can say, yes, I did, well, then it's okay to cash the check, and that's just a legal fee-splitting arrangement. Now, the reason why this rule always gets looked at when we talk about referral fees is that, some lawyers will say, well, referral fees are okay as long as what I got paid is in relation to the amount of work I did. Well, you're not really wrong if you say that, but you're kind of admitting guilt if you say that, because really referral fees are not allowed. What is allowed is fee splitting based upon the amount of work you did. So that's kind of like saying, murder is allowed in Minnesota as long as you murder the person in self-defense. Well, I guess that's not exactly wrong, but if it's self-defense, then it's not murder. Similarly, if it's a legitimate fee-splitting arrangement, then it's not a referral fee. So don't go in and admit guilt by saying, I'm going to cash this check for my referral fee. But it's okay because in getting this referral fee, I did some of the work. I was in proportion to the amount of services. So whatever you do, don't call it a referral fee. If you want to get a referral fee, don't admit guilt from the outset. Say, well, no, this is not a referral fee. I'm cashing this check because in proportion to the services I provided. Now, I used to, so that's it for referral fees for right now. Now, I used to just kind of end right there. And then, I noticed one nervous-looking attorney in the audience, and then I got back to my office, and there was an email saying, well, you left off some important words. And he was right. I did leave off those important words because the fee splitting can be based upon the amount of work I did in proportion to the services that I provided, or it could be in relation to the fact that I maintained responsibility for that case. So I didn't actually lift a finger and actually do anything on the case, but I got this check when it was over because I was responsible for what was going on during the whole time. And, of course, most referral fees to take place under that prompt. But again, don't admit guilt by saying, I got a referral fee, but it was okay because I maintained responsibility. No, you split the fee with the other attorney for maintaining responsibility. And, oh, and by the way, you also happen to be the attorney who referred it to them. But like I say, don't admit guilt by saying that it was a referral fee because, well, that's not permitted under the rule. That would be an illegal referral fee. Okay, in our last about 3 minutes here in today's program, we're going to blast through Rule 1.6. And Rule 1.6 says that everything is confidential. And if I had a little bit more time today, I would spend it by differentiating that from the attorney-client privilege, because this rule is not talking about the attorney-client privilege. The attorney-client privilege is another kind of confidentiality. But in fact, the attorney-client privilege actually rarely comes into play. There are so many exceptions to it that we think of it as this sacrosanct thing, but it's really pretty narrow. So don't get the two confused. And if I had more time, I would talk a little bit more about the attorney-client privilege. But here, the kind of confidentiality here, not an evidentiary privilege, but simply saying, you know, what you can get in trouble for. You can get disbarred or suspended for violating this rule, even if it's not privileged, because Rule 1.6 says that everything is confidential. You shall not reveal anything about your representation unless the client consents to it, or it's a disclosure that's impliedly authorized to carry out the representation, or if there's some other exception. So in other words, everything your client tells you is presumptively confidential, and you kind of need a reason to give that out. So if you don't have a good reason for it, well, you violated the confidentiality. Now, the biggest reason why you do disclose things, because we disclose things all the time, because that's what our clients hired us to do. We communicate for a living. That's what we do for our clients. You know, your client tripped and fell on the sidewalk, and they're hiring you to communicate that information to the judge and the jury and the insurance company or whoever. But the burden of proof will be on you to show that this disclosure that you made when you called up the insurance adjuster, was that communication impliedly authorized to carry out the representation? So in other words, there has to be a good reason for any disclosure. What if your client is about to commit a crime? Again, we only have about 2 minutes, so I'll blast through this pretty fast, but hopefully it doesn't come up too often. What if your client tells you they're about to commit a crime? Well, depending on your state, you are either permitted or required to disclose that information by virtue of this rule. So if your client tells you, I'm just fed up with these other people, so I'm going to go over and murder them right now. Well, you're to be commended for having such a open communication with your client that they feel they can confide that information on you. But in Minnesota, because you are required to disclose that information, if you think it's necessary to prevent a crime involving death or serious bodily injury or substantial financial or property loss from taking place. So if it's a major crime, you're required to disclose it. But on the other hand, if it's a minor crime, your client confides in you that they're going to go down and commit an act of shoplifting at Target and steal a candy bar, well, that's not a serious enough crime. So there, the duty of confidentiality still holds. And not only are you not required to disclose that information, you're not permitted to disclose it because you got it in confidence. Now, where is that dividing line? Well, I don't know exactly where the dividing line is. You know, your client's going to steal $1 million, you probably have a duty to disclose that. If your client is going to steal a candy bar, you have a duty not to disclose it. Unfortunately, wherever that cutoff point is, you either have a duty to disclose it or you have a duty to keep it confidential. If you're not sure, you know, if your client wants to, is about to steal $100, well, I don't know what to do. That's why other states, like Nebraska, that say you may disclose the information, I think that's actually a better approach because that gives you the discretion in those middle areas. So if your client says that they're going to steal $1,000, I would probably call the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility and ask them, is that a substantial enough amount of money that I have to disclose it? I'll wrap up here just in a second, but before I do, I'm going to give the third of our three code numbers from the first hour of the program, E132 is the third code number, the third and last code number for this first hour of the program, E132. Just wrapping up Rule 1.6, other possible exceptions to confidentiality, and there will be others in other parts of the program. You are allowed to reveal client confidential information to secure legal advice about your conduct of the rule. So when you talk to that lawyer down the hall saying, what should I do in this ethically sticky situation, you're asking for legal advice so you can reveal client confidential information in that circumstance. Also, you can do it to comply with the court order. If the judge orders you to provide that information, complying with that order in good faith is a defense to the confidentiality here. Although, you might need to talk to your client about, I think we better appeal this order when the judge told me to reveal that information. You might have a duty to do that. So anyway, that brings us up just over an hour. So we're gonna wrap up part one of the program here today. I will pause briefly for any questions. And hearing none, I'm gonna turn off the recording. For our podcast listeners, again, on my my website, there are instructions on where to send those code numbers. If you don't have that handy, it's clem.law@usa.net. If you're just listening to this program and you want to find out more about the program, you can find it at my website, richardclem.com. And I look forward to seeing you at future programs.